In the coming week, tension between China and Taiwan builds. Anthony Blinken begins his first week as President Biden's Secretary of State, and governments race to procure the COVID-19 vaccine while virus variants emerge. It's January 28, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, this past weekend, Chinese Air Force planes, including several fighter jets, entered Taiwan's air defense identification zone. After 2 days of this activity, a U.S. aircraft carrier group led by the USS Theodore Roosevelt entered the South China Sea to promote freedom of the seas, the United States military said. Can you bring us up to speed, Bob, on what's happening in the area and why Americans should be paying attention?
They should be paying attention because we're entering a period of tensions that we haven't seen, according to many close observers, in about 25 years or so, which is, while China has routinely kind of mounted such incursions as shows of its basically reminders that it is there, it claims Taiwan, and it continues to view it as a renegade province, the volume, of its overflights and the proximity of U.S. forces at the same time, and the sort of the repeated nature of this occurring as a new U.S. administration takes charge, all of it leads to an alarming spectacle, I guess you should say, at this point. We should note our colleague Paul Stairs' team has just released its new Preventive Priorities Survey, where they've elevated the Taiwan tensions to a top-tier concern, which basically means something that U.S. officials should be concerned about, something that has a potential to spill over. And so all of which says that given what's going on, we should be concerned. I should also note that I've been reading a little bit more on this, and I'm not really clear on the sequencing of these overflights in Taiwan's air defense zone and the Theodore Roosevelt entering the South China Sea. I'm not sure whether they happened right around the same time or one resulted in the other. I think they were both happening simultaneously to some extent.
I should note on the U.S. Freedom of Naval Operations operation that that's been a policy of the U.S. government for quite some time.
That's right.
And clearly under the Trump administration, there were more of these operations trying to establish what has been a longstanding principle of American foreign policy, that is freedom of navigation, freedom of the seas. And one of the ways you do that is by sending your ships through areas where you believe international shipping is allowed to go. And I know U.S. naval officials will say things like, we conduct freedom of naval operations, even with our closest neighbors like Canada.
That's right. And while China has claimed virtually all of the South China Sea as its sort of sovereign territory, that is not recognized by the countries in the neighborhood, whether it's the Philippines, whether it's Vietnam, or so forth. So the U.S., again, conducting these operations as a sign that it's conducting what it sees as legally permitted and something that it wants to continue to indicate its presence and its willingness to help kind of police this. But China is changing and trying to change facts on the ground by creating atolls and so forth. That's a whole separate issue, although related. It's a whole South China Sea situation. Meanwhile, with Taiwan, by its proximity to South China Sea and U.S. forces sort of making a play there, that's also significant. Jim, I should also point out that these aerial incursions by the Chinese military occurred after Taiwan's de facto ambassador to the U.S. attended the inauguration of President Joe Biden last week. And this is reported to be the first Taiwanese envoy attending an American presidential inauguration since 1977. It also followed some sort of final moves by the Trump administration to lift restrictions on meetings between U.S. and Taiwanese officials. That also ended a number of years of self-imposed restrictions, which did not please Beijing, shall we say.
That's an important point, Bob, and I think we need to stress that the United States government has not regarded Taiwan as a country since 1979, when Jimmy Carter established relations with mainland China. We refer to it as an entity, and that's why you see in government documents we'll refer to Taiwan as Taiwan, as an island, but we've not referred to it as a country. And I think you're quite right that Beijing, and particularly Xi Jinping, is very nervous and concerned about the closer U.S. relationship with Taiwan that we saw begin under Trump. And I think it's pretty clear, given the invitation to Biden's inauguration, that it's going to continue in a Biden administration. The Chinese are also concerned that Taiwan itself is making many steps toward independence, which Beijing has said is a no-go for them, a clear red line. I want to say that the Taiwanese government insists it is not moving toward independence, but this is something to keep an eye on. But there's also a broader context here, Bob. We've alluded to it before in our conversations, and that is Chinese foreign policy in recent years under Xi Jinping has become much more aggressive. We're seeing that with Taiwan. We're seeing it in the South China Sea, as you mentioned, but you're also seeing it in the Himalayas and the borders with India. And I will note that just this week, the Indian government said that its relationship with China is at a crossroads because of the month-long military confrontation in the Himalayas. And so I think it's going to be very important to watch this going forward, because China, as it becomes more powerful, is flexing its muscles, and it is putting pressure on countries, not just in East Asia, but elsewhere, to have to make choices about whether to concede or to stand up to Beijing.
It's a great point, Jim. And you can continue to add that list, by the way. You know, you can add Hong Kong, where the one country, two systems approach and agreement really was supposed to hold sway for many more years. China has short-circuited that, by all appearances, is moving into cert control. And what you're seeing is what a number of close watchers say is that, you know, while people are accustomed to Chinese coercion of various sorts to try to get its provinces or places that it sees as renegade provinces to toe the line, Chinese coercion has been exercised for years, but there's a military edge to this that we're seeing now, a military and or a policing hard edge that is a new thing. And it's all part of Xi's kind of nationalism, his assertion of Chinese power and so forth. And that's different. And that's why, again, this raises the concern, the Taiwan theater raises concern about a confrontation with the U.S., which, as you said, recognizes that it's part of China, but it also has unofficial ties that seem to be getting a little bit more official with Taiwan. And it provides arms to Taiwan for purposes of self-defense, which, you know, incredibly irks China. Well, Jim, President Biden's incoming Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has Taiwan on his plate among many other priorities and crises. He did win bipartisan support in the Senate and addressed the State Department in a speech just this past week. Could you sum up what he had to say in that opening message and what's in store for him in his first few weeks on the job?
Certainly, Bob. Tony Blinken was sworn in yesterday, 7 days after Joe Biden was inaugurated, which underscores a point we've made several times in the podcast, that the Biden administration may have begun on January 20th, but it's going to take months to actually staff it up. I will note that Blinken, who is the 71st Secretary of State in U.S. history, as things stand right now, doesn't have a Deputy Secretary of State confirmed. No Undersecretaries of State are confirmed. No Assistant Secretaries of State are confirmed. Indeed, when you look at ambassadorial appointments, traditionally what happens at the end of an administration, ambassadors resign and you wait for new people to get appointed, and that requires Senate confirmation. So much of the diplomatic apparatus of the United States government is still waiting to be staffed up. Blinken has one thing going for him, is that the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which handles nominations for the State Department, this is Senator Jim Rich of Idaho, said of Blinken, quote, "This is the person for the job." It's a nice way to start off. But obviously, Blinken is going to have a very full plate. And it is a workload that is really both internal and external. I mean, we normally think of the Secretary of State interfacing with the rest of the world, but one big challenge that Secretary Blinken has is rebuilding the State Department. Now, again, he's a veteran of the State Department. He began his career in Washington as a special assistant in EUR, that's the European Bureau. In the latter half of the Obama years, he was Deputy Secretary of State, so he's a man who knows the building well. But it's also a building that has about 1,000 fewer employees than it did when he left 4 years ago as Deputy Secretary of State. There's been a massive outflux of very talented people. Anyone who's been in a big organization knows losing people is dangerous, because you lose not just talent, but you lose institutional knowledge, sort of knowing how to make things work and run. And so Secretary Blinken did what Secretary of State typically do. On his first day, he came in and gave a morale-building speech to his team. It was a rather odd event to watch. Normally, you would have the Secretary of State give this speech to a multitude of people, and you would sort of feel the energy of the crowd. But of course, because of COVID, people working remotely needed social distance. If you watch the video of Secretary Blinken's speech, and he actually references this, he's really talking to a very sparse crowd. But I think his main message to the State Department team is, you matter. We're going to go and do big things, and we have to rebuild our ranks. You put a particular stress on building a State Department workforce that is multicultural, that reflects the diversity of the American public. And again, historically, the State Department has sort of lagged the changes in the broader demography of the United States. You know, it was often said of the State Department, it was male, gale, and pale, I think was a common refrain I've heard. Now, it's not quite the way it was back in the 1940s and 1950s, but it is still an organization that doesn't look like America. And I think Secretary Blinken committed himself to that. One just last point, Bob, which is typically when a Secretary of State first takes over, particularly at the beginning of an administration, there's a big focus on where is the Secretary going to travel. Typically, the Secretary goes out, visits foreign capitals, goes on what might be called a reassurance tour. And so far, the Blinken team hasn't indicated where he is going to go or when he is going to go. The only reference he made to it in his speech yesterday was that he looks forward to traveling and that he will work with the press and talk to the press on their travels. But obviously, with COVID-19, I think some of the typical diplomatic travel may be scaled back.
Jim, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things in the inbox, so to speak, in terms of both continuity from the Trump administration, but also breaking. And continuity, I guess I would signal what seems to be a desire to maintain a peace process with the Taliban and maintaining Zal Khalilzad as an envoy and sort of, you know, seeing how that process is going to play forward. But also in terms of breaks, the freezing or at least a pause in aid to the Saudi Arabia and UAE, I believe was reported just yesterday. And what that signals in terms of the relationship with those two countries that had a particularly close relationship with the Trump administration, but also what it signals for, say, policy in Yemen.
Well, I think the big word here is review, Bob, and that is the team has come on, or part of the team has come on, and they have lots of decisions. And I think what they want to do is to create breathing space where they can actually go and review these policies, and we talked before, give themselves a chance to get staffed up. Obviously, the Trump administration on the way out made a number of decisions about its policy preferences. Some of those decisions were clearly at odds with what the Biden administration wanted to do. And so they're going to begin to slowly either walk those decisions back or at least halt them going forward. One of the big questions, obviously, about a Biden foreign policy is, what is his message going to be to those countries that actually like Trump's foreign policy? I mean, it's very clear from what President Biden has said that America is back, that he's going to work with America's traditional allies. As we talk, this is a message that resonates with the Europeans. The Japanese kind of like it. The Australians kind of like it. The South Koreans kind of like it. But there are countries that are actually really nervous. Think Israel, think Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, think Egypt. And so this is where the Biden team is going to have to flesh out its policies. It's one thing to get tougher on some of your closest friends because you don't like their policies. For example, Saudi Arabia's policy in Yemen, but you also need these countries for things that you care deeply about. And the big issue here for the Biden team is Iran. That's still the issue that the Biden team really hasn't settled. It's indicated it wants to go back into the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, but it hasn't really signaled how it intends to get back there. It has seemed to have said that it wants the Iranians to get back in first, and they will then join. The Iranians say, we're not the one who left first, so we're not making the first move. And again, it's quite clear that America's friends in the Middle East, particularly the Israelis, the Saudis, and the Emiratis, don't want to go back into, or don't want to see the United States go back into the Iran nuclear deal. I believe it was the Israeli military chief of staff who said he thought it was a really bad idea if the United States went back into the deal. So this is where the Biden people are going to have to sort of navigate among sort of competing pressures they're going to feel. Okay, you can push the Saudis on this issue or the Israelis on this issue or the Emiratis on this issue, but how is that likely to redound to those issues like Iran where you need them?
The only thing I would add to that, Jim, is the first phone call between President Biden and President Putin took place. There was reporting from both sides about the phone call. It's something we haven't seen in recent years. And it seems to be the case that they did talk about the Navalny detention and what that means and a whole array of other big issues between the U.S. and Russia, including arms control. But it's raised the issue of how much much the administration, how much somebody like Tony Blinken might get involved in sort of pursuing and messaging human rights concerns or political freedoms concerns in Russia, which has been dismissive of those certainly in recent years and scornful actually of them in the past from the U.S.
You're quite right, Bob. And it is interesting that the Biden administration is going back to the pre-Trump standard of giving the press readouts, at least of the top level discussion with foreign heads of state. Second thing that's really interesting about the readout is that the Russians also provided one, and they did not mention Navalny.
That is right.
In their readout. Again, as you know,
they don't like to say his name in any event. So certainly
I believe Vladimir Putin has referred to him as the person who was poisoned. So clearly Putin believes that mentioning Navalny by name only empowers him. And obviously Putin faces some growing protests. And we'll see what happens over the weekend on that score, because there's been a call for additional protests in Russia. But quite clearly, the Navalny issue is one that the Russians would prefer the Americans not raise. And it's quite clear that the Biden team has raised it. Now, obviously, there's not much the Biden team can do about what is essentially an internal Russian matter. But the fact that you can't make the Russians change their mind doesn't mean that you don't want to put pressure on the Russians on this score. And I think that's part of what the Biden strategy is about.
I would just note one final thing to that, Jim, which is one of these areas that's a little bit under the radar in foreign policy is U.S.-funded international media, in this case, U.S. Agency for Global Media, where the Biden team very quickly came in and sort of removed a number of people or asked for their resignation.
They got the broom out, Bob. They swept.
They got the broom out, and it's from the CEO, Michael Pak, down to agency heads. I say this in this context, Jim, because it also involves one of the more sort of dedicated U.S. media campaigns that involves Russia, which is basically broadcast. Whether it's digitally, radio, or television to Russia, programming from Russia about what's going on in the country. And we're starting to see signs that Putin is going to basically throw out any journalists affiliated with that agency, which would be a first. But at the same time, basically, because they have a network of journalists and are able to report from Prague, it's still seen as a sort of an effective way of getting information disseminated within Russia. So I just note that as a signal that they want to maintain that capability in Russia and in elsewhere.
Well, I think it's clear that the Biden people see Voice of America and the rest of that apparatus as an important amplifier of American values, the American point of view. They want to depoliticize it. That's, I think, sort of their complaint about the Trump appointees. But they want to also invest more resources in this, in essence, to sort of match not just the Russians, but I think particularly the Chinese in terms of soft power, getting America's message
right.
out. So I think this will be something to watch, because obviously what one person sees as a politicization of an agency, another person might see as a wise use of the agency. And this is one where I can imagine you can get real split between Republicans and Democrats, as we see in many other areas. But Bob, let's switch topics and talk about the development and distribution of the COVID-19 vaccine. Over the past few weeks, we have seen the vaccines being met by challenges posed by mutations in variants of the virus. They seem to be popping up in different places around the globe, from the United Kingdom to South Africa to Brazil. Now, these mutations produced the new variants. These new variants have raised questions about whether or not the COVID vaccines we have generated are going to be effective. So can you give us some understanding, Bob, of what we think the issues are and what we think the challenges may be?
Sure, Jim. First, it's worth pointing out again what many experts have said, which is that all viruses mutate, and some of those mutations make them weaker, some make them more resilient against vaccines. And it's that latter prospect that's starting to worry public health officials around the world. I would just note, as we're taping this podcast, there's new reports coming in that one of the variants that was reported, the South African variant, which seemed to be more resistant to vaccines, has now been reported in South Carolina. Two people have been infected with that variant. They have no history of traveling. So there's a concern that it's now what they call community spread of that one. The Brazil variant, another one seemingly more resistant to vaccine, has been reported, I believe, in Minnesota. And then the previous variant was the UK one, which, according to many tests, vaccine had still seemed to be resilient. Part of this gets way beyond my competency in terms of what vaccines work and what don't. I think it's worth noting that some of the vaccine makers like Moderna are already prepping potentially another round of shots that could bolster the effectiveness against the variant. It's not clear how much the new variants are completely resistant to vaccine or whether it's just a little bit more of a weaker strain, which we see in sort of in like flu vaccines and things like that. It's worth noting. It's also worth noting on the positive front that it seems like another vaccine may be coming online shortly. This is one that Johnson & Johnson is developing. Next week, we're expecting some announcements from them on the latest trials and potentially a request for emergency authorization. That's significant because it's a single shot. It's not a two shot, so not a shot and then several weeks later a booster. It's a single one, and it does not require the extremely cold temperatures to store it, all of which would help, I think, if they're able to produce enough of it, help accelerate the distribution of the vaccine, because that's another issue that's becoming a huge sore point, especially in Europe, which is the ability of vaccine makers to make enough so that countries can ramp up the distribution and get the vaccines into arms, Jim. It seems to be moving much more slowly than anticipated in the United States. I think we're at the level of maybe 25 to 30 million people have received the vaccine. The Biden administration is hoping, again, to get this 100 million in 100 days figure hit, but there's still concern about what can be accomplished in the course of this year based on previous expectations. So as the Federal Reserve Chairman said just yesterday, you know, there's nothing more important for sort of economic revival in this country than getting the virus under control and the vaccine distributed.
You certainly raise important points, Bob. And I would stress one thing, which is when we're talking about these variants, there's a lot of uncertainty about how they might change the challenge that we face. And there's always a risk that people want to make definitive declarations about these variants before scientists have really had a chance to study them. And I just want to emphasize, we talk about the novel coronavirus. The word novel is there because these are new. We haven't seen them before. So we don't quite know. So I will note, for example, that some recent studies suggest that the variant that emerged in South Africa and the variant that emerged in Brazil may not be handled as well by the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines, or put it differently, that the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines may not be as effective against those variants, which is obviously of great concern. But even those conclusions are based on some early lab tests. It's not based on field work. We're seeing what's actually happening in day-to-day life. There's also something important to keep in mind here. Neither you nor I are virologists, but there's really this question of to what extent can the vaccines be adjusted to handle the emerging variants? And there's some reason for optimism on that score, but it's not definitive. That's very frustrating, I think, for most people, because it's like one moment we have a vaccine, it's 95% effective. Yeehaw, by July, everything will be back to normal. And then you get these stories where you have the variants and now it looks like the vaccines may not work. We don't like uncertainty as people. We like clear, definitive conclusions. Unfortunately, I think that we are going to be facing a bit of uncertainty for some time to come because of the very important point you made, which is that viruses mutate. That's the nature of biology, and we're going to have to find ways to deal with it. And again, the technology so far has been pretty impressive. Again, the fastest vaccine to this point took 4 years. We're talking about this in less than a year. Yes, I know these vaccines have been under development one way or another for quite a long time before then, but there are some potential technological solutions. I think our bigger challenge immediately is, as you point out, the real challenges we faced here in the United States and abroad, both to produce enough vaccine and to get it in people's arms quickly. And that's of great concern. And it's been a great variation among countries in how effective they've been in distribution.
All good points, Jim. I would just note also on the positive ledger that there does seem to be growing signs that people in the United States and elsewhere in the world, there's some growing receptivity to wanting to be vaccinated, which is yet another hurdle to face. A recent survey cited this week showed that the number of Americans who want to be vaccinated as soon as possible has risen from 34% to 47%. You still want that higher, but it does show there's interest in it. Again, raises the stakes for wanting to get these vaccines that have gone through their paces and their trials out and into arms. And we'll just keep taking stock of it. I would also note our CFR affiliated site, Think Global Health, has lots of information on this and has people who are in the healthcare field writing about this. And so I would refer people to that site too.
Okay, so Bob, I have to ask you, are you one of the 47%?
Yes, I always have been. I was one of the 34%, yeah.
Okay. I'd get the vaccine as well. I'm not eligible for it, but as soon as I am eligible, I would get the shot. I have great confidence in the safety of the technology and the vaccine.
Yeah, it's for me, it's a no-brainer. And I hope it becomes more baked in around the country. But Jim, all this talk about numbers and figures makes me think about figures of the week. And good thing, because our audience figure of the week is ready. Our listeners have voted, and actually they can vote every week or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected the figure 1 trillion, as in 1 trillion ton ice loss. Jim, why is this figure significant?
It's significant, Bob, because it shows how much we have affected the climate upon which we depend. And the numbers that the audience referred to were summarized in an article or study published in the journal Cryosphere. And it shows what we've all known, which is that ice is disappearing rapidly around the world. Now, I could quote you a lot of numbers. You know, for example, we've lost something on the order of 760 billion tons a year in the 1990s to something like 1.2 trillion tons per year in the 2010s. But I think when you start talking billions and trillions, Bob, it's hard to make sense of what all that means. I think the big picture here is we're conducting an uncontrolled experiment with our own climate, and we are likely to rue the results of that uncontrolled experiment. Let me just note a couple of things. One, when you lose ice, it affects habitat. All kinds of plants and animals depend upon certain habitat. Might want to call this the polar bear problem, right? You talk about the loss of their habitat, but it's not just about polar bears. You have the issue of sea rise. Now, again, not all melting ice leads to increases in sea level, but when you have ice that is on land, it melts, it goes in the ocean, sea levels rise. That is going to pose tremendous challenges to cities that are near the ocean, and much of humanity lives along coasts, and you raise sea level a foot or so, you have massive problems because we've built massive infrastructure. Think of a city like New York and the challenge that is posed there. I think beyond that, you have the reality that if you have ice loss, that actually accelerates climate change, because when ice retreats, it exposes either land or ocean. And guess what? Sunlight that comes down is absorbed by land and ocean, whereas sunlight when it hits snow or ice is reflected. This is what's referred to as the albedo. And snow and ice is very good at reflecting light back up, whereas, again, land and ocean absorb it. So it basically sustains a vicious cycle. And I think finally, this just tells us there's a lot of momentum built up in the system. I mean, even if we went carbon neutral tomorrow, and we stop pumping out heat-trapping gases, the fact is we've already initiated a series of events in our climate that are going to continue to unfold. And again, some of these have the real potential to become self-sustaining. You talk about the loss of permafrost in certain parts of the world. Think Siberia, think Alaska. That unlocks a lot of carbon that's actually been frozen. That can add to it. So this is, again, of great concern. And the problem is, as we've talked about too many times in this podcast, the action on the political level to deal with climate change hasn't been anywhere near what we need to do. Now, this happens to be the week in which the Biden team rolled out a bunch of initiatives. They're all by executive order. Yes, they are important. Yes, they are necessary, but they are by no means sufficient. And that is the problem. And it's not just the United States. I would simply note that if the United States did everything right to limit carbon emissions, the reality is China is building literally hundreds of coal-fired power plants that are going to make the problem that much worse. That's why dealing with climate change requires getting lots of countries, particularly the big emitters, to reduce their emission of heat-trapping gases.
Yeah, and among the reasons why it's been given a priority, but not only that, it's been officially labeled a national security priority for the United States. So, you know, across the government, you're seeing this treated as such. Again, it doesn't mean the debate's over within the U.S. Congress and between Democrats and Republicans, but you do have a party in power that's prioritizing this. So it'll be interesting to see how far they can take it while understanding that change is already going. We've had a mini experiment in the past year under COVID where this huge slowdown in things like air travel and emissions from plants and so forth. And yet the number of extreme weather incidents that seem to be linked to climate change have continued, as well as the measurements in and of themselves and signs like, you know, this week's figure of the week as well, Jim. So yeah, lots of work to do.
Lots of work to do. And again, Bob, I'm pessimistic when it comes to seeing Congress go along with any agenda that the Biden team proposes, because it faces opposition from Republicans. In the United States Senate, you need 60 votes to get anything done. The steps needed to deal with climate change can't be handled in the context of so-called reconciliation. That's the sense of the get out of jail free three card for the filibuster, but you can't handle climate change to that since the changes you're making there aren't budgetary. Reconciliations are restricted to budgetary measures. Climate change is really going to take or require moves on the regulatory front. So I continue to have grave concern about our ability to rise to the moment.
And that's our look at the warming world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Next week, February begins, which means the presidency of the UN Security Council rotates, this time from Tunisia to United Kingdom. And the martyrdom anniversary of Mahatma Gandhi is marked.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be safe out there.